540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha. Always streaming on the Civic Media app.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis. Every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., we talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
So all you folks out there, if you haven't registered to vote, register to vote, get ready to vote. There are so many things on the ballot this November, at our freedom, our liberty, and our way of life. But we'll get to all of that this evening.
The Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson. Listen Monday, 7 to 8 p.m. on the Shaw 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
Day equals day. Greg Bach Day.
It is. Put that on your tombstone.
Oh, yeah.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
Yes, you've just convinced me towards a burial service now. That's it.
Was it cremation before? Was that your go-to?
Viking funeral?
Listen to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry right here on the Shaw 101 FM and WAUK 540 AM.
27% of the American workforce, and some even say 30%, were in unions who had representation and who clearly did not have to worry about whether or not they were going to get their fair share. But I'm definitely going to fight for people who get the short end of the stick in this society only because they don't have representation. That's who I am.
Check out the Earl Ingram Show every day from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. only on WAUK 540 AM 101 FM, The Shaw.
Women get a lot of advice about self-care these days, but one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
My mother was very familiar with her neighborhood, but one day she stopped at the stop sign and she wasn't even really sure where she was at.
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council. The Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council present the story of Cynthia and Ed.
My mother was always very active and independent, and she was familiar with her neighborhood. But one day, out of the blue, she stopped at the stop sign for much longer than usual. And she didn't know whether she should go forward or turn or just stay at the stop sign. She wasn't even really sure where she was at. She was very concerned. It was very unsettling for her.
It's important for you to talk to someone about it, to bring the family in on it. I felt so much better after my son told me, "Mom, I don't want you to worry or be afraid. I'll be there for you and we'll figure it out."
When something feels different, it could be Alzheimer's. Now is the time to talk. Visit alz.org/ourstories to learn more. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
This is the story of a very special woman. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician or an entrepreneur. Her knowledge was limitless and still is. She could also make monsters disappear, especially those that lurked in the shadows under the bed. Once, this woman put back together a teenage girl's broken heart, which had been shattered in 1,000 pieces, just by giving her a bear hug. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Hey, sis, missed you this morning. Kim told me you weren't feeling well, so I'm just doing a self-care check.
Ah, thank you, friend.
How you doing?
Girl, listen, my energy was so low because I didn't eat breakfast when I got up, so I had to miss virtual yoga with y'all.
Trust me, I understand.
But I'm doing much better now that I've eaten, so I'm back on track.
Great. In that case, let's get some steps in tonight. I'll come over and we can walk around the lake.
Sounds good. Appreciate you being in my business, too. Now, let me get in yours. Did you check your blood pressure today?
I did that and my squats, okay?
Okay.
High blood pressure is not going to be my friend if I can help it. See you at 6?
Let's get it. See you then.
Now more than ever, it's important that we protect our hearts and the hearts of those we love. Check in on one another and be a part of a healthy blood pressure movement. Rally your squad to take the online pledge at releasethepressure.org. Brought to you by the Release the Pressure Coalition and the Ad Council.
What is dedication?
I think a parent's job is to protect our children, but also prepare them for the world so they become good, kind human beings.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media. To learn more, go to our website, civicmedia.us.
As much good work you do, it seems like there is someone who outshines everyone, which is Pepper the dog. Pepper the dog, to be clear, is the most favored employee in the DA's office, and I'm reminded very frequently that she comes way above me. I've worked at the courthouse a long, long time. I think there are many people who don't know my name, but they will scream Pepper across the building at me. And one day I was walking to my car to go to the doctor, and someone screamed out like the third story window, "Where is Pepper?" Like, she's in the office. It's okay. I just have to go get my teeth cleaned or whatever I was doing.
Moving Wisconsin forward, one joke at a time. This is Kristen Bry with As Goes Wisconsin.
Yada, yada, yada.
Hello, Wisconsin!
Hello, Wisconsin. Happy Friday. How you doing today, Jane Matnair?
I am also very, very glad it is Friday, and we got a great show coming
we
up today.
We have a great show
we
coming
do.
Up. So, today at the 11:30... Marquette professor and of romantic literature, Ben Platick, is going to be joining to talk to us about the lasting legacy of Les Miserables.
Which is running now. It's what? Running through Sunday.
It's running through Sunday at the Marcus Center for Performing Arts in Milwaukee. You know, but we never shy away from an opportunity to talk about musical theater. However, we're going to talk a little bit more with the professor about the actual origin material being Victor Hugo's classic novel.
Right. And I mean, you taught me more about Les Mis than I had ever known, because we walk away from that musical thinking that was the turning point for the French Revolution, and that was not the case.
Not the case at all. And so we will talk more about the themes of that story and why they've lasted for so long. Like, it's still one of the most popular musical, I think, in all time.
Wow.
Potentially. Or, like, I don't know how you, depending on what measurement you use. But so that'll be 11:30. And then at the top of the lunch hour, we are talking Badgers and kind of Marquette. We are going to have Molly Haggerty, who is a 3-time All-American for Badger volleyball player. She's since graduated, but she's going to join us to talk a little bit more about potentially the anticipation of the NCAA tournament starting, which the Badger women's volleyball has a number one seed.
Well done.
So very well done. So talk a little bit about that. And then later in the half hour, the long-lasting rivalry between men's Badger basketball and Marquette basketball. And so my father is going to join us because he played part in that rivalry in one of the most infamous Wisconsin sports stories of all time involving Al McGuire. So we'll talk about that. And then at 12:30, Allison Chavez from Planned Parenthood Wisconsin is going to join to talk about implementing a community-centric model across the state with Planned Parenthood. And we'll probably get an update as far as how healthcare is going for women who are still, or not even just women, because men can go to Planned Parenthood too.
Definitely.
So we'll get an update there. And then at 1 p.m., friend of the show, Laura Lyons, comedian, is back to talk about her new piece in The Daily Beast, which is the 8 things you should never say to someone who has Long COVID.
And she knows from which she speaks.
Yes. And so if you've never heard Laura on the show before, she is my dear friend who is an incredible comedian, but she also was in a coma for 3 months because of COVID. And so she has very intimate knowledge as far as how to talk to someone who is still dealing with the long. I mean, and this probably goes for anyone who has either a chronic illness or disability or something as far as, but for her specifically, it's because of COVID. As always, you can join the conversation on any of these topics we have coming up today at 844-967-2789. And a quick housekeeping ahead of this weekend, the Waukesha Christmas Parade is this Sunday.
Yes.
So our coverage on this, on our home station, WAUK, the Shaw, begins at 3 p.m. with Don Brown as your host, and the parade begins at 4 p.m. So don't miss a minute. Tune in for this year's Waukesha Christmas Parade on WAUK, 540 a.m. and 101 FM, the Shaw. But for us to start off the show, this feels like big news, and I'm tussling with it as far as if it's a good thing or not. I think as a consumer, potentially it's a good thing. But as far as our trade-off between people's health and us getting our stuff on time and profits, it feels like not necessarily a win.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, I feel like after the last couple years of post-COVID, the post-COVID world, we've largely embraced telling people when you're sick, don't come to work.
Which was a new thing, actually.
Yeah.
Because we always kind of expected you're going to suffer through it and you're going to come into work because we need you coming to work.
And we, you know, we talked about this right when I got back, which I've only been back for a week. It feels longer than that. But on Monday when I was back, we were talking about how Americans don't, one, we don't have any guarantee for vacation days, but also we don't, aren't very good at taking them. But that the same thing applies to sick days. And for so long, I think before COVID, it was you power through, you still show up to work, you don't take a sick day, people are relying on you. And then the conversation became, well, if you have COVID, you can't come into work.
Don't come.
And I think that expanded to, if you have now, I mean, especially this year, RSV or influenza, but just in general, if you're not feeling well, don't come to work. But again, for a lot of jobs, that's possible. With technology now, a lot of things can be done remotely. And one of those things, one of those jobs that is not possible to do is something like railroad workers. And whether you've been following the story closely, but obviously I think every day for the last week, once again, the railroad strike has been in the news. And yesterday, or this week, I mean, I guess this week, basically, for the first time in 30 years, Congress has intervened ahead of another potential railroad strike, and with pressure from President Biden to get it done. And so both chambers took action this week and passed it. And at least in the House, they were trying, because the big hang-up here is paid sick leave.
7 days.
7 days. And so in the initial negotiation, which I think was back in September, is that when it was? The last time we were hearing about this, I think they had negotiated for like one. Because right now, besides the fact that 80% of laborers in the U.S. do get some sort of paid sick days, that's not the case for railroad workers. And so this week, the House tried to, in passing this intervention, was trying to have guaranteed, would have guaranteed them 7 days of paid sick leave, but that measure failed or stalled in the Senate because they couldn't get 60 senators to say, yes, this should be part of the negotiation, that they should get 7 sick days. And so it looks like this is happening. It's moving forward, at least as far as Biden signing this and forcing the issue. And I don't want to underplay the importance of the railroad system, as far as it's something like 40% of our country's freight is taken on the railroads. And like in one, I think I read this, is a single day without functioning freight rail would cost the U.S. economy an estimated $2 billion. So it is a big deal. And it's, then you think about the compounding effect of what it is shipping. So if fertilizer is going to, it doesn't get to the farms, and then all of a sudden that affects food prices. And so, like, I don't want to underestimate or underplay the importance of it all. And it's not just like, well, we want our gifts on time. However, it still feels like people who are laborers shouldn't be forced to predict when they're going to be sick.
Well, and additionally, it's just so short-sighted to not include sick days. I just don't understand. I really don't understand why that is such a big sticking point. They did give them a 24% pay increase, right?
So this is, so there is a great article in New York Magazine written by Eric Levitz, that breaks this down as far as what is the hang up here. And so I highly recommend reading it. I'm going to probably summarize a lot from it today as far as try to talk through this, but it's because part of the original negotiation was these, as he refers to them as the railroad barons, as in Baron Robbers. And you know, what they did agree to, they had no problem handing out a 24% raise, $1,000 bonuses, caps on healthcare premiums. But what they drew the line at is paid sick days. And why is this the thing that they're hung up on? And it sounds like it comes, at least in this article, it's arguing that it's because of this thing called PSR, precision scheduled railroading.
Okay.
So it's basically an operational strategy that tries to minimize the ratio between the railroad's operating costs and their revenue through, like, different cost cutting. I don't know why it needs a special name, because I feel like that's what most businesses
Isn't
do.
Isn't it called a budget?
Yes. It's like, how do you manage costs while optimizing profits? Like, that is what capitalism is, right?
Pretty much.
And so they give it this, like, special name. But there's, you know, and there's certain ways you can do that. So that's like, you could make trains longer. So there's only one train with more cars on them that are traveling at any one point. But you can also, like, streamline scheduling. And so, like, having as it's almost like how, like, the airplanes, right? Like, on our nightmare sometimes of when, oh, your flight has been canceled for no apparent reason. I think one of the reasons is sometimes, well, it wasn't full, so we're going to lose money on this flight. And so kind of the same idea, it seems like, what I'm understanding this to mean, is the idea that you have less trains run that are more full, and it's brings down the operating cost. And so this is their argument as far as the guys in charge of, they've cut labor by like 30%. And so what it ends up being is that they're not giving on paydays, but because they can't, because it will disrupt
that model.
It will disrupt that model because they're basically working with like the exact amount of people that they need, and none of them can have an unexpected day off.
But
which feels inhumane.
Well, and it's going to happen.
I know.
It has happened.
And it's also the long-lasting effects of your workers. So we got to take our first break. But if you have thoughts on this, as always, join the conversation, 844-967-2789. We'll wrap up this conversation as far as the trade-off on the railroad strike when we come back. This is As Goes Wisconsin. Stay right there. Mrs. Daddy, won't you treat him right? Now you've listened to my story. Here's the point that I have made. Chicks were born to give you fever, be it Fahrenheit or centigrade, to give you fever. When you kiss them fever, if you live, you learn. Fever till you sizzle. What a lovely way to burn.
You are listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Thank you. Did you know we are always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app too? And if you miss a show or game, find it wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, civicmedia.us.
Hi, it's Don Brown, host of This Week in Waukesha, inviting you to catch our coverage of this year's 2022 Waukesha Christmas Parade, Sunday, December 4th. The coverage starts at 3, the parade starts at 4. We'll be live in front of the Walk Radio studios talking to the marchers, the participants, the fans, and all the people that make this parade in this community a very special place. Waukesha Christmas Parade, covered here on Walk Radio 540 AM, 101 FM, The Shaw.
This local musical interlude is brought to you by Max Inc. Radio, VO5.
Let's do it on the dance floor. Let's do it.
Listen to Max Inc. Radio every Saturday and Sunday, 6 p.m. to midnight. Download the podcast at maxincradio.com. We are local music.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
Here's your updated forecast on The Shaw. A wind advisory begins at 2 a.m. this morning and continues until 9 a.m. this morning. Overcast skies overnight with a chance for scattered snow showers. Lows level off around 17. Winds out of the west, 20 to 25 miles an hour. Highs around 25 tomorrow. Clear skies tomorrow night. Lows level off around 16. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 45 degrees.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. We are talking about, I don't know if this is the biggest story of this week, but it is one of the bigger national stories of the week as far as the pending railroad strike that will not happen because Congress intervened.
But trust me, if it had happened, that would be what everyone is talking about because it would have impacted all of us.
But it's just, I just find it frustrating that the railroads have a combined, all these different companies that run the railroad freight systems have a combined $27 billion net income. And as you might imagine, the people who are at the top of these companies are doing just fine.
I think so.
And they can afford to give their workers paid leave, and they can also afford to hire more people that would mean that there is more flexibility as far as someone last minute getting sick, being able to take care of themselves. But it also would require people at the top willing to cut some of their passive income. And since they don't want to do that, and it's one of those moments where it's so frustrating to watch Democrats not always align with what they talk about. You know, I mean, I think Bernie Sanders is obviously someone who was, there was more progressive politicians in both the House and the Senate who were like, we have to give people more sick leave. And it just didn't happen. And it just feels like, why does this always come back to workers instead of the people who are making millions, if not billions of dollars?
Well, and certainly one of the only cards that workers have is to strike when it's really inconvenient.
And most of them don't, right? Because unions are just down. Like,
right.
You and I can't strike.
Right. But you have no, if you wait until any random Tuesday and say we're going to go on strike, it's not going to have the weight it is as it does right before a major holiday. This is the leverage that you have. And that was just taken away from them.
Yeah. It feels, because here in the article that breaks this down, I highly recommend if you're interested in learning more about this. It's called Why America's Railroads Refuse to Give Their Workers Paid Leave. And it's New York Magazine, written by Eric Leavitz. And he outlines, I don't know if it's people that he spoke to directly, but the Times spoke with someone, but some of the anecdotal stories of what happens when you don't give laborers, in this case, railroad laborers, time off. So it said one middle-aged union engineer postponed a doctor's visit for work, then died of a heart attack on the job weeks later.
Oh, that's terrible.
And then a different story of a conductor who spoke with the New York Times and they began to feel run down, but they declined to see a doctor because they thought they were going to be disciplined for taking an unplanned day off. And instead, this person waited for months for the next doctor's appointment that aligned with his scheduled day off. And he learned that he'd been suffering from an infection that could have been treated with medication like weeks ago had he just been able to go see the doctor.
Well, and think about the flu is very prevalent right now, and we're going to be talking to Dr. John Raymond on Monday from the Medical College of Wisconsin just about flu numbers, and COVID is still a thing, and people are still dying of COVID and mm-hmm. RSV and everything. How does this help you if one of your railroad workers comes to work, is ill, spreads it, and now half your workforce is out sick because they can't function because they're so ill?
Well, it's also just so backwards. It's like you have to use your paid vacation days when you're sick, but that has to be requested off weeks in advance because
you're
going to never know when we're going to be sick.
That doesn't make any sense at all.
And so obviously this is not, it's one of those things where it's like, well, this doesn't affect me because in the way that it turns out, anything that would have been inflationary as far as costs rising even more or things not getting delivered on time, you know, for the average consumer, this isn't going to, it's going to be a good thing for them. But it just, from an empathetic level of just like, really, this is 7 days is asking too much.
There's an article I found in The Lever, which says the CEOs of the 5 largest railroad conglomerates have made more than $200 million in just the last 3 years. Company shareholders boosted by nearly $200 billion in stock buybacks and dividends over the last 12 years. There's enough money. It's just the people who are making the most money don't want to make less money.
Well, and it's not like they're passing that off to shippers. Like, it's not like it's helping. Like, they're pocketing that money versus this whole idea of what we said before, the PSR, what does it stand for? Where did I see it? Now I can't find where I put it.
Pretty savage violin.
Yes, thank you. This method, this operational strategy, precision scheduling railroading.
There we go.
It's not working the way that they claim it does as far as being good for everybody. Because they're not passing off, like, making prices go down because the shippers aren't paying less for shipping. And it's just creating an environment where they could be paying more workers to have more flexibility, and they're just choosing not to. And now they have the strength of the U.S. government backing them, which I think is not a good thing.
And it's very disappointing.
It is disappointing. It's a disappointing thing that it's why people... Honestly, this is what comes back to when people make the argument that both sides are the same, which I don't subscribe to, but that both sides, there's no difference between Democrats and Republicans, that they both have big money in their pockets, that ultimately everyone's bottom line is how policy and regulations end up getting decided and voted on in Congress, because that's the lobbyists. That's who's paying for
our politicians,
like campaigns. And it's just, this feels like an argument in that way. It's like, oh yeah, this is, at the end of the day, our politicians, most of them still pick big money over workers. So, all right, well, we're going to move on to Les Miserables when we come back. So stay with us. Marquette professor Ben Platick will be here when we come back. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
I'm going to stop. We can't.
The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK, 540 AM, Waukesha's only news talk station.
You are never far away from your favorite radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. And if you missed your favorite show or game, listen to a podcast of it anytime on the app or our website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome to the Devil's Advocates.
The Republican Party on a national level, how many years did they investigate Hillary and Bill? They're still going to that. Trudy. So
they're still looking for her emails, right? But they don't look in the Trump septic tank for half the top secret classified documents that he was flushing during his term. When one party doesn't care about governing, just don't allow anything to happen when the Democrats are in charge. And then they think the American people are going to get boonswoggled into voting Republican again.
Follow the Devil's Advocates on Facebook and Twitter.
We have a full hour with Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley.
Yes, thank you for having me. So glad to be in studio.
Listen Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. for As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
You know, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, whether you are a union member or a business owner, picking up your garbage has no partisan lines. Making sure people can get to and from work shouldn't have partisan lines.
Listen to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry right here on The Shaw.
We have to really understand how critically important a time this is. Time for talk is over. The time for action is now. Because my voice has always been and will continue to be for people who don't have a voice.
Tune in to The Earl Ingram Show every Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Only on WAUK 540 AM, 101.1 FM, The Shaw.
Dad, I picked up your pills, made your lunch, and your laundry is done.
When you care for a loved one, you take care of everything. But are you taking care of yourself? Find free care guides at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
It's 4 a.m. and you're sucking baby snot through a tube because she's congested. If you love her that much, love her enough to make sure she's buckled in the right car seat. Find out more at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Hey, Dad, your prescription will be ready in just a minute. Hey, Dad, your laundry will be ready in just a minute. Dad, your lunch will be ready in just a minute.
Hey, honey, why don't you take a minute?
When you help care for a loved one, you give them as much time as you can, making sure they're safe and comfortable. But it's just as important that you take some time for yourself. At AARP, we can help with information and useful tips on how you can maintain a healthy life balance, care for your own physical and mental well-being, and manage the challenges of caring for a loved one. Because the better care you take of yourself, the better care you can provide for your loved one.
Thanks, Dad.
Thank you. You're there for them. We're here for you. Find free care guides to support you and your loved one at aarp.org/caregiving. That's aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
If a natural disaster comes knocking, how prepared is your family? You can't just close the door on earthquakes, floods, or hurricanes and hope they go away. That's why it's important to make a plan now. Ready.gov/plan has the tools and tips you need to prepare your family for an emergency. So if disaster shows up at your doorstep, you'll be ready. Visit ready.gov/plan and make a plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
I grew up hearing that women are bad with money, but I pay bills and take care of my family, so I'm pretty good with money. And now I'm taking control of my financial future by saving for retirement. Jumpstart your retirement savings at WeSaySaveIt.org. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
I dreamed a dream in time gone by.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. As always, you can listen to us all across the Civic Media Network and join the conversation at 844-967-2789. So, still the world's most popular musical, Les Miserables. We're bringing this up because Les Mis is back in Milwaukee. It started last weekend. It's running through Sunday at the Marcus Performing Arts Center. But Jane, how many times do you think you've seen Les Mis?
I think I've seen it 4.
Live.
Yes.
So I think I've seen it twice live, but the I remember the recorded performance of the 10-year anniversary. I don't even know how many times I've seen that, but then there's like multiple movies. I was so obsessed with this musical as a kid. And I tried to read the novel.
By Victor Hugo,
because I loved the musical so much. I think it was like 7th or 8th grade, and it was a little little dense. I'm not sure. I think a lot of things went over my head. But to talk about the long-lasting legacy and why this story is still so impactful and gets at the heartstrings of so many people, our guest this half hour is Professor Ben Platick, who is an associate professor of romantic literature at Marquette University and a lifelong Les Mis fan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Kristen. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you. So I guess just right off the bat, what's better, the play, movie, or musical? I mean, a play, movie, or book?
Oh, that's such an unfair question. They're all so different. And that's one of the glorious things about this book is that it can sustain so many different adaptations, doing so many different things. I mean, as a literature professor, it is kind of my job to say, this book is great and you should read
it.
Oh my God, it's massive.
It's 3.5 pounds in this edition, which is a really good translation, a newish translation by Christine Donahue. You can see there, but
I just have to describe it since this is an audio medium for anyone who's not watching the live stream. That was thicker than I think any dictionary I've ever seen. And that was definitely not the version I tried to even read in eighth grade. That one was much thinner than that. That is a massive.
That's phone book sized.
Oh yeah, it's huge. My students have gotten made fun of a little bit for carrying it around campus sometimes.
So you teach the book in one of your classes.
Yes, I'm actually teaching a semester-long course on the book right now. It's the only book we're reading, which is still a lot more reading sometimes than other classes. But my students have been troopers about it, and they have deepened my own relationship with this book, which is really fantastic. I read it for the first time when I was 16. I don't remember now if I'd actually heard or seen the musical first, but okay. I fell in love with the book, and I've tried to read it once or twice a decade ever since, and it changes every time.
So when you see the length of the actual original written piece, even translated, compared to what can fit into a 3-hour musical or the movie versions, and there are multiple movie versions, one that is the musical with Anne Hathaway and who really proved how much she can't sing, the Australian actor, Russell Crowe.
Yes.
It's like, oh, not a great Javert. But then even before that, Liam Neeson was in a version with Claire Danes as Cosette, and Liam Neeson was in mm-hmm. it, and that was no musical. But what do you miss? How many more plot lines or details that you think are really important that are in the book that we never even, if you've only seen the musical, you don't even know of?
Actually, honestly, the musical does a pretty good job of capturing the core plot of the book. One of the interesting features of this text is that so many of these pages, and for audio listeners, I'm holding up the book and kind of like rifling through it. So many of these pages are not plot-based, but kind of essays that Ugo included as part of the historical context he wanted to give readers. So there's 50 pages on Paris's sewers. There's 50 pages on the Battle of Waterloo. There's 50 pages on slang.
Oh, wow.
And one of the one of the reasons Ugo does this is because one of the key points the book is making is that all of the terrible social problems that the book chronicles in the lives of individual characters are systemic problems. And he wants to give you the context for those systemic problems. So he says, you know, here's a family in poverty. Here's what poverty in Paris looked like over the past 20 years. Here are the causes that led to it, both historical, social, and cultural. And so the musical can't include a ton of essays. Yeah. What it does do a really good job of is actually having choruses of effectively marginalized people singing as if they were a Greek chorus, the points that the essays make. So, for example, the musical opens with the convicts saying, "Hi, the French penal system is terrible. Look down. You're going to always be somebody who society looks at as a lesser person." And, you know, this book, if nothing else, is a treatise that is like a very early version of what we now call prison abolition. Ugo does not think prisons do a good job at all of, you know, trying to put criminals back into society. He actually thinks that they, you know, prisons create more criminals. And so that's the kind of context that you can't really replicate in anything, honestly, except a long book. But the musical does a pretty damn good job.
And so in the historical context of when Victor Ugo wrote this book, how far removed were they from, because I don't know the timeline, how far removed were they already from the French Revolution?
So the French Revolution began officially in 1789. Ugo published this book in 1862. So
it was almost,
you know,
okay.
it's Yeah, so nearly, like, it's a generation later, almost 100 years later. However, the book, I like to tell people that the book is and is not about the French Revolution, because its focus is one of the various aftershocks of the French Revolution, the 1832 June Rebellion. But it's a book that is primarily concerned with the massive seismic changes that the French Revolution caused across Europe, and in its symbolism as a revolution that technically failed, but spiritually succeeded, because it brought the hope to Europe that eventually other European nations could overthrow their monarchies and institute something that looked like democracy. And Hugo actually began writing the book in the 1830s and 40s, so well before it eventually was published. And the major difference and kind of like major shift to the book happened in 1848, which was the other major, major revolutionary year in the 19th century when countries across Europe overthrew their monarchs, tried to institute democracy. Some of them succeeded, some of them didn't. France very briefly, after having gone back to a monarchy after the French Revolution, instituted a second republic, which lasted for all of, oh God, like, you know, maybe a year or so before the French, and I don't know why this story is relevant now to preface this remark. The French elected Napoleon III, who was a nephew of the original Napoleon, who was a kind of demagogue, who then a year later staged a coup and made himself emperor. So that profoundly disillusioned Hugo. He got exiled by this new Napoleon because he was a little R Republican who was like, you know what, democracy is a great thing. The death penalty is bad. And maybe we should do something about economic equality. Napoleon was like, bye. And so he lived in exile for the next like couple of decades of his life and published Les Mis from exile. So it's the book is also kind of a critique of Napoleon III and also of the French people's tendency to sort of elect demagogues who then take over the country.
That's all fascinating. We're talking to Professor Ben Platic, who is the Associate Professor of Romantic Literature at Marquette University and is currently teaching a course on Les Miserables, the book, and we're talking about this because Les Mis, the musical, is at the Marcus Performing Arts Center this weekend. And so I want to get back into more like the historical context, because one of the things I think as a kid, and even Jane and I were talking about this the other day, is a misconception about the musical is the context of the fight scene, like the war, the battle, right? And then in reality, historically, it was like not a big, it was not even a blip on the actual revolution or anything. And it was like squashed so quickly that in history books is basically not even mentioned. And it's really only this story, this novel that brought to light the historical context of that battle, right?
Yes, absolutely. We only kind of know slash care about the 1832 June Rebellion because of Les Mis.
Which is so funny to me. So, but what do you think it is? Because it's obviously for us as Americans, this is not our history. This is something that happened a very long time ago in a different country as far as where the story is set. And yet, whether it's the book, the musical, the movies, like this has such a place in our, for those of us who like musical theater, in our hearts. And so what do you think the themes of the story are that get its hooks into so many people?
So to connect that to your point about no one really remembering the 1832 rebellion, I think it's a profoundly idealistic book that puts all of its faith in the real possibility of political change. And Hugo could have done this story by talking about a moment where change really happened. Like he could have said it in 1848. He could have actually written a book about the revolution. He did a few years later. It's called 93. It's about the terror. But instead, he chose to write about a rebellion that failed. And part of the book, like I think what makes the book so meaningful to every generation that has come after it is that it is the book about how even in times of political darkness and political failure, you have to keep the faith and believe that history is going to get better, that people are going to institute the kinds of changes they want to see in their governments that make the world a better place for everybody. And the book believes in this so profoundly in part because it tells the story of a moment where, you know, in practical terms, it didn't happen. The revolution, this little rebellion did fail. But so many of Hugo's long speeches throughout the book are these kind of rousing discussions of why we should try to keep the faith and keep fighting. And I think that that theme is really resonant across history for so many people. And it's why the musical, for example, ends with a kind of singing again of the song, Do You Hear the People Sing, is because I think this book has come down through history as a book about you know, what happens when your revolution fails? Well, you keep fighting, and here's why.
Oh, that was so well said. And I had the music of that song in my ear, and I got chills just thinking, because it's so powerful of like how the show ends. And also, it's also so sad. I mean, almost everyone dies. and thinking about all of the themes that are obviously the revolution part, but the penal colony and the poverty and the sickness and everything that was happening as far as, but the, you still end this show. And I'm assuming, since I never actually finished the book, you finish the book feeling like, well, at least not depressed, and that you do feel somewhat hopeful as far as the desire to keep going. And so Victor Hugo, was he also a journalist? Was he just a novelist, or who, like, what was his, was he just a Renaissance man who did a lot of different things?
He was a little bit of a Renaissance man. He wrote an absolutely staggering amount. The kind of fun story that I like to tell about him is that he always hit his word count every day because he didn't let his servant bring him clothes until he'd hit it. That's apocryphal, but I like telling it. So he was somebody who was deeply interested in social justice and did do a lot of what we would now kind of call investigative reporting. His first major novel was actually kind of based on a real life story. It came out in 1829. It's called The Last Day of a Condemned Man. And it was about a man who was sent who was guillotined for a minor offense. And that kind of deeply shaped the way that Hugo understood his relationship to his work. And so there's a very real way in which every single one of his books is political, and he does a ton of research to produce them. He also wrote a bunch of essays, and eventually, before getting exiled, was in the French National Assembly, where he stood up for universal suffrage, free education, getting rid of the death penalty, and economic justice. Interestingly, as a conservative, so that word does not mean necessarily what you think it means in 19th century France.
Yes, words change. There's different definitions of all those things. Because when you were describing as far as the book having so all these essays, the first thing that popped in my head was Upton Sinclair in the Jungle, and the what was a novel but was also a piece of investigative reporting, and what that did to shape the labor movement in this country. And so it's interesting to put that into context as far as there was purpose behind the writing besides just telling a great story.
Absolutely. Hugo does not let you escape reading the book without knowing exactly where he stands on a number of important issues and kind of hitting you over the head with what he thinks ought to be done.
That's so funny. All right. Well, we're going to keep you through the break because I think not only is there probably more, I have another couple questions as far as character development of Les Miserables, but we also want to talk because you're writing a novel that takes place in Wisconsin. So we'll come full circle with that. Our guest this half hour is Professor Ben Platek, who is an associate professor of romantic literature at Marquette University. Stay with us. This is As Goes Wisconsin.
WAUK will be broadcasting the Waukesha Christmas Parade live, and you can become a sponsor. Call us at 262-232-8164. Sponsorship includes an on-air interview during the live broadcast of the Christmas Parade. A portion of the proceeds goes directly to the Waukesha Memorial Fund. Please call at 262-232-8164. That's 262-232-8164.
27% of the American workforce, and some even say 30%, were in unions who had representation and who clearly did not have to worry about whether or not they were going to get their fair share. But I'm definitely going to fight for people who get the short end of the stick in this society only because they don't have representation. That's who I am.
Check out the Earl Ingram Show every day from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. only on WAUK 540 AM 101 FM, The Shaw.
Only life had a remote control. You could pause or rewind. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. Take the 1-minute risk test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. A wind advisory begins at 2 a.m. this morning and continues until 9 a.m. this morning. Overcast skies overnight with a chance for scattered snow showers. Lows level off around 17. Winds out of the west, 20 to 25 miles an hour. Highs around 25 tomorrow. Clear skies tomorrow night. Lows level off around 16. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 45 degrees.
The Shaw 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk from Big Bend to Menominee Falls. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
Do you hear the people sing, singing the song of angry men? It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again. When the
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bryan. We could probably just play that for the next 8 minutes, but then we wouldn't be able to talk to our guest for this half hour, Professor Ben Vladek, who is the Associate Professor of Romantic Literature at Marquette University and is teaching a course this semester on the book Les Miserables. And we're talking about this because Les Miserables, you can still see it this weekend at Marcus Performing Arts Center in Milwaukee. And my question for both of you is, which character do you most identify with from Les Miserables?
Oh my God, what a great question. That has changed with every, okay. The older I get, it shifts. When I was younger, I mean, I'm basically a professor because of a speech Enjolras makes two-thirds of the way through the book where he says, light, light, everything comes from light and everything returns to it. Citizens, the 20th century, or the 19th century was great, but the 20th century will be happy. And it's a speech where he's saying, you know what the most important thing is? Education. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to become a professor. These days, I find myself actually, you know, relating a bit more to Jean Valjean and even to Marius's grandfather, who are these kind of older people who watch the tremendously powerful and brave things that the younger generation are doing, and want to protect them, especially, and, you know, help them through what will eventually become a kind of disillusionment, because that's the process of the book. You know, you are young, the barricades fail, you're disillusioned, how do you keep going? And so now I'm, you know, I'm not like super old yet, but I'm at the stage in my life where I am teaching a bunch of students who are full of like really amazing idealism, and I want to help them.
Like, help them, protect them, but also like keep going. It's inspiring, but yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Jane, do you have a...
Professor, you described that so well, I am stealing that answer. And because I am old, and I do feel that, even just with the people that I work with.
Yeah. And you demonstrate that. You're constantly... I mean,
well, you want to nurture them and take care of them and make sure that, you know, the things are okay.
That's funny. I feel like my answer, as I always wanted to play Eponine, had I been able to sing, the amount of times I tried to sing her main song. But in reality, if we were to be honest, I was probably a lot more like Cosette. As far as I was not a tough street kid, as even though I played one in A Christmas Carol. I think most of us always thought Eponine was like, when she dies, a little drop of rain. Sheesh. All right, so enough a lot about Les Miserables, because I want to talk a little bit more about your work, because you have a book, your second novel coming out next year.
Oh, no, it's first novel.
Oh, this is their first novel, okay.
Yeah, first novel, second book.
What is that? What's the difference? So the book was nonfiction?
The first one is an academic book, yeah.
Got it. Okay, so I misread that. So first novel,
no worries.
And it takes place in Wisconsin.
It does, yes.
So what? Can you tell us more of the plot?
Sure. So it's called Dryland. It is about a forester in the early 20th century who discovers that he has this kind of magical ability to grow plants, and is immediately drafted to grow war timber in World War I. Pretty soon after he discovers this magical power, he discovers that all the plants he creates die. And he's a fervent conservationist and preservationist and desperately wants to kind of use his power to restore some of the ecological landscapes that he loves so dearly, especially Wisconsin, and especially a marsh that I've named Clearwater Marsh, but is actually Horican. And so the story sort of follows him trying to make his power work for conservation. And it ties in a lot of Aldo Leopold's work, and it also ties in the early 20th century dredging and refilling of Horican Marsh.
Wow. How did you come up with this story?
I moved to Wisconsin. I've only lived here for like 8-9 years at this point. And one of the things that I have fallen in love with about the state is the natural landscapes and the just rich history of sort of ecology that exists here. And I was inspired by reading Leopold's writing, but also by looking at the really interesting history of the various kind of ecological areas of the state. So everything from the Driftless to the sand counties in the middle of the state to the Northwoods, which were all cut down, and then people tried to make them into farms, and that kind of failed, and they ended up being national forests, a lot of that land. So I find that history immensely interesting.
But I still wonder, Professor, I mean, are you laying in bed one night and you go, you know, he's got a magical power and I'm going to call him Walter.
Basically, I mean, the other thing that I'm interested in is just the difficulty of conservation. And I think sometimes we often wish for magical solutions to long-standing and seemingly like irresolvable problems like climate change. So I was like, what if in the early days when clear cutting was still happening, somebody had a magic power to reverse clear cutting? And it kind of doesn't really work because ecological restoration isn't accomplished by magic. It's accomplished by, you know, years of labor and working together and understanding the land that you're on. So there is no magic fix.
How much did you know? How much research did you have to do? Because I feel like it's always fascinating to me as far as creative writers, novelists, who have a story that they so want to tell. And it's not unlike Les Mis, right? There is the historical fiction of it all, of the amount of research and understanding of the time, the profession, the like you said, what did conservation look like back then? And so how much did you already build on knowledge that you knew, and how much research actually did you have to go do in order to write the story you wanted to write?
So the knowledge basis that I had was having a kind of I'm a romanticist by trade, so I study 18th and 19th century British literature, where people cared an awful lot about nature. So I have a kind of, I was already familiar with ideas about what nature is and meant kind of in the European and American context in the 19th century. And I know from just doing a lot of hiking around Wisconsin, like I have a familiarity with the landscapes. In terms of the specific context of, you know, like the early forestry service, World War I, and some of the people that I based the, you know, the book on, or the people's writing, like I did end up doing a lot of reading. One of the kind of main things I did was read a whole bunch of old forestry manuals and ecology textbooks from the early 20th century to try to get a sense of how did people actually think, you know, ecology worked? Like what did they know? What did they not know? And that was a large part of my reading, as was just like everything about Leopold, who was such a great documentarian of those shifting tendrils and ecological thought, as well as a beautiful writer of Wisconsin nature.
Oh, well, I can't wait. That sounds so niche, but also fascinating. So it comes out next year?
Yeah, fall 2023 from University of Wisconsin Press, which is so appropriate because the book wouldn't exist without their back catalog.
Absolutely. There you go. That's incredible. And so where else, before we let you go, where else can people find either your work or your social online presence?
So if Twitter exists in a year, I'm at bplatic at Twitter. And there's a link to my website from my Twitter profile. But you can also just kind of Google Ben Platic, and my Marquette University webpage pops up. So those are probably the easiest places to find me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I already learned so much more about Les Mis, despite loving it for so long, than I already knew. And so I'll have to follow up with you at the end of the semester to see what the grading curve was for all your students reading that long, long book.
They're all awesome. They've done such a good job.
Well, thank you so much. Professor Ben Platic is Associate Professor of Romantic Literature at Marquette University. We thank you for joining us today, and we'll have to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great pleasure.
All right. Have a great day. Okay. We'll take a break for the top of the hour news. And when we come back, Molly Haggerty, a volleyball alum, will be here to talk about the NCAA tournament.
Missed your favorite show live on air? It's easy to find what you enjoy wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts. And we're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app.
The radio show your mother warned you about.
Actual tyranny of a dictator. Dictator is going to dictate Putin. And what did Trump do? Trump kneeled to the man. Embarrassing Republicans. And you're still with the guy? This is your front runner in 2024? You've been smoking some of Mike Lindell's crack. What are you thinking?
They're the GCCCP. We are the devil's advocates.
Live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6.
I love this song.
I love nachos.
Loving everything? You might be buzzed.
You know what I'd love? A ride when it's time to head out.
If you see a buzz warning sign, call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.